him, madam." She frowned. "I hardly keep track of his movements, but if pressed, I would say 2 nights ago, he was quite agitated."
"Agitated?"
"It was the downed airman. He was most unhappy that he had not been found. Herr Captain believed someone was hiding him."
"Someone?"
Vianne forced herself not to look away, nor did she tap her foot nervously on the floor or scratch the itch that was making its uncomfortable way across her neck. "He searched all day for the airman. When he came home, he was... agitated is the only word I know to use. He drank an entire bottle of brandy and broke a few things in my house in his rage. And then..." She paused, letting her frown deepen.
"And then?"
"I'm sure it means nothing at all." He slammed his palm down on the table so hard the light shuddered.
"What?"
"Herr Captain suddenly said, 'I know where he's hiding,' and grabbed his sidearm and left my home, slamming the door shut behind him. I saw him jump on his motorcycle and take off down the road at an unsafe speed, and then... nothing. He never returned. I assumed he was busy at the Kommandantur. As I said, his comings and goings are not my concern." The man drew a long drag on his cigarette. The tip glowed red and then slowly faded to black. Ash rained down on the desk. He studied her from behind a veil of smoke.
"A man would not want to leave a woman as beautiful as yourself."
Vianne didn't move.
"Well,"
he said at last, dropping his cigarette butt to the floor. He stood abruptly and stomped on the still-lit cigarette, grinding on it with his boot heel.
"I suspect the young Hauptmann was not as skilled with a gun as he should have been." "The Wehrmacht," he said, shaking his head. "Often they are a disappointment. Disciplined, but not eager."
He came out from behind the desk and walked toward Vianne. As he neared, she stood. Politeness demanded it.
"The Hauptmann's misfortune is my fortune."
"Oh?" His gaze moved down her throat to the pale skin above her breasts.
"I need a new place to billet. The Hotel Bellevue is unsatisfactory. I believe your house will do nicely."
When Vianne stepped out of the town hall, she felt like a woman who'd just washed ashore. She was unsteady on her feet and trembling slightly. Her palms were damp, her forehead itchy. Everywhere she looked in the square were soldiers. These days, the black SS uniforms were predominant. She heard someone yell, "Halt!" Saw a pair of women in ratty coats with yellow stars on their chests being shoved to their knees by a soldier with a gun. The soldier grabbed one of the two and dragged her to her feet, while the older one screamed. It was Madame Fournier, the butcher's wife. Her son Gilles yelled,
"You can't take my maman,"
and started to surge at the two French policemen who were nearby. A gendarme grabbed the boy, yanked hard enough to make him stop.
"Don't be a fool."
Vianne didn't think. She saw her former student in trouble, and she went to him. He was just a boy, for God's sake, Sophie's age. Vianne had been his teacher since before he could read. "What are you doing?" she demanded to know, realizing a second too late that she should have tempered her voice. The policeman turned to look at her. Paul. He was even fatter than the last time she'd seen him. His face had puffed out enough to make his eyes as small and slitted as sewing needles.
"Stay out of this, madame," Paul said.
"Madame Mauriac,"
Gilles cried.
"They're taking my maman to the train. I want to go with her."
Vianne looked at Gilles' mother, Madame Fournier, the butcher's wife, and saw defeat in her eyes.
"Come with me, Gilles,"
Vianne said without really thinking.
"Merci,"
Madame Fournier whispered. Paul yanked Gilles close again.
Enough! The boy is making a scene. He is coming with us.
No, Vianne said. Paul, please, we are all French.
She hoped the use of his name would remind him that before all of this, they'd been a community. She'd taught his daughters.
The boy is a French citizen. He was born here.
We don't care where he was born, madame. He's on my list. He goes.
His eyes narrowed.
Do you want to lodge a complaint?
Madame Fournier was crying now, clutching her son's hand. The other policeman blew his whistle and prodded Gilles forward with the barrel of his gun. Gilles and his mother stumbled into the crowd of others being herded toward the train station.
We don't care where he was born, madame.
Beck had been right. Being French would no longer protect Ari. She clamped her handbag tightly beneath her armpit and headed for home. As usual, the road had turned to mud and ruined her shoes by the time she reached the gate at Le Jardin. Both of the children were waiting in the living room. Relief loosened her shoulders. She smiled tiredly as she set down her handbag.
You're all right? Sophie said.
Ari immediately moved toward her, grinning, opening his arms for a hug, saying,
Maman!
With a grin to prove that he understood the rules of their new game. She pulled the three-year-old into her arms and held him tightly. To Sophie, she said,
I was questioned and released. That is the good news.
And the bad news?
Vianne looked at her daughter, defeated. Sophie was growing up in a world where boys in her class were put in train carriages like cattle, at the point of a gun, and perhaps never seen again.
Another German is going to billet here. Will he be like Herr Captain Beck?
Vianne thought of the feral gleam in von Richter's ice-blue eyes and the way he searched her.
No,
she said softly. I don't expect he will be. You are not to speak to him unless you must. Don't look at him. Just stay as invisible as you can. And Sophie, they're deporting French-born Jews now. Children, too. Putting them on trains and sending them away to work camps. Vianne tightened her hold on Rachel's son.
He is Daniel now, your brother. Always, even when we are alone. The story is that we adopted him from a relative in Nice. We can never make a mistake or they'll take him, and us, away. You understand? I don't want anyone to ever even look at his papers. I'm scared, Maman,
she said quietly. As am I, Sophie, was all Vianne could say. They were in this together now, taking this terrible risk. Before she could say more, there was a knock on the door, and Sternbahnfuhrer von Richter walked into her home, standing as straight as a bayonet blade, his face impassive beneath the glossy black military hat. Silver iron crosses hung from various places on his black uniform, his stand-up collar, his chest. A swastika pin decorated his left breast pocket.
Madame Mauriac, he said. I see you walked home in the rain.
Mais oui,
she answered, smoothing the damp, frizzy hair from her face.
You should have asked my men for a ride. A beautiful woman such as yourself should not slog through the mud like a heifer to the trough.
Oui, merci. I will be so bold as to ask them next time.
He strode forward without removing his hat. He looked around, studying everything. She was sure that he noticed the marks on the walls where paintings had once hung, and the empty mantle, and the discoloration in the floor where rugs had lain for decades. All gone now.
Yes. This will do.
He looked at the children.
And who have we here?
He asked in terrible French.
My son,
Vianne said, standing beside him, moving in close enough to touch them both. She didn't say Daniel in case Ari corrected her.
And my daughter, Sophie.
I do not remember Hauptmann Beck mentioning two children.
And why would he, Herr Sturmbahnfuhrer? It's hardly noteworthy.
Well, he said, nodding crisply to Sophie. You girl, go get my bags.
To Vian, he said.
Show me the rooms. I shall choose the one I want.
Chapter 28. Isabel woke in a pitch-black room, in pain.
You're awake, aren't you?
Said a voice beside her. She recognized Gaetan's voice. How often in the past 2 years had she imagined lying in bed with him?
Gaetan, she said,
and with his name came the memories. The barn, Beck. She sat up so fast her head spun and dizziness hit her hard.
Vian,
she said.
Your sister is fine.
He lit the oil lamp and left it on the overturned apple crate by the bed. The butterscotch glow embraced them, created a small oval world in the blackness. She touched the spot of pain in her shoulder, wincing.
The bastard shot me, she said,
surprised to realize that such a thing could be forgotten. She remembered hiding the airman and getting caught by Vian. She remembered being in the cellar with the dead flyer.
And you shot him.
She remembered Beck flinging the hatch door open and pointing his pistol at her. She remembered 2 gunshots and climbing out of the cellar, staggering, feeling dizzy. Had she known she'd been shot? Vian holding a shovel covered in gore. Beside her, Beck in a pool of blood. Vian, pale as chalk, trembling.
I killed him.
After that, her memories were jumbled except for Vian's anger.
You are not welcome here. If you return, I'll turn you in myself.
Isabel lay back down slowly. The pain of that memory was worse than her injury. For once, Vian had been right to cast Isabel out. What had she been thinking to hide the airman on her sister's property, with a German Wehrmacht captain billeted there? No wonder people didn't trust her.
How long have I been here?
4 days. Your wound is much improved. Your sister stitched it up nicely. Your fever broke yesterday.
And Vian? She is not fine, of course. So how is she?
We protected her as best we could. She refused to go into hiding. So Henri and Didier buried both bodies and cleaned the barn and tore the motorcycle down to parts.
She'll be questioned, Isabel said. And killing that man will haunt her. Hating doesn't come easy for her.
It will before this war is over.
Isabel felt her stomach tighten in shame and regret.
I love her, you know. Or I want to. How come I forget that the minute we disagree about something?
She said something very similar at the frontier.
Isabel started to roll over and gasped at the pain in her shoulder. Taking a deep breath, she steeled herself and eased slowly onto her side. She'd misjudged how close he was to her, how small the bed. They were lying like lovers, she on her side looking up at him, he on his back staring at the ceiling.
Vian went to the border?
You were in a coffin in the back of the wagon. She wanted to make sure we crossed safely.
She heard a smile in his voice, or imagined she did.
She threatened to kill me if I didn't take good care of you.
My sister said that?
She said, not quite believing it. But she hardly believed that Gaetan was the kind of man who would lie to reunite sisters. In profile, his features were razor sharp, even by lamplight. He refused to look at her, and he was as close to the edge of the bed as he could be.
She was afraid you'd die. We both were.
He said it so softly she barely could hear.
It feels like old times, she said cautiously,
afraid to say the wrong thing, more afraid to say nothing at all. Who knew how many chances there would be in such uncertain times?
You and me alone in the dark, remember?
I remember.
Tours already feels like a lifetime ago, she went on.
I was just a girl, He said nothing. Look at me, Gaetan.
Go to sleep, Isabelle.
You know I will keep asking until you can't stand it. He sighed and rolled onto his side. I think about you, she said.
Don't.
His voice was rough. You kissed me, she said. It wasn't a dream.
You can't remember that.
Isabelle felt something strange at his words, a breathless little flutter in her chest. You want me as much as I want you, she said. He shook his head in denial, but it was the silence she heard, the acceleration of his breathing. You think I'm too young and too innocent and too impetuous. Do everything. I get it. People have always said that about me. I'm immature.
That's not it.
But you're wrong. Maybe you weren't wrong 2 years ago. I did say I love you, which must have sounded insane. She drew in a breath. But it's not insane now, Gaetan. Maybe it's the only sane thing in all of this. Love, I mean. We've seen buildings blown up in front of us, and our friends are getting arrested and deported. God knows if we'll ever see them again. I could die, Gaetan, she said quietly. I'm not saying that in some schoolgirl try to get the boy to kiss me kind of way. It's true, and you know it. Either one of us could die tomorrow. And you know what I would regret?
What?
Us.
There can't be an us is, not now. That's what I've been trying to tell you from the beginning.
If I promise to let it go, will you answer one question truthfully?
Just one?
One. And then I'll go to sleep, I promise. He nodded. If we weren't here, hiding in a safe house, if the world weren't ripping itself apart, if this was just an ordinary day in an ordinary world, would you want there to be an us, Gaetan? She saw how his face crumpled, how pain exposed his love.
It doesn't matter, don't you see that?
It's the only thing that matters, Gaetan. She saw love in his eyes. What did words matter after that? She was wiser than she'd been before. Now she knew how fragile life and love were. Maybe she would love him for only this day, or maybe for only the next week, or maybe until she was an old, old woman. Maybe he would be the love of her life, or her love for the duration of this war, or maybe he would only be her first love. All she really knew was that in this terrible, frightening world, she had stumbled into something unexpected. And she would not let it go again. I knew it, she said to herself, smiling. His breath skimmed against her lips, as intimate as any kiss. She leaned over him, her gaze on him, steady, honest, and turned off the lamp. In the dark, she snuggled against him, burrowed deeper under the blankets. At first, he lay stiffly against her, as if he were afraid even to touch her. But gradually he relaxed. He rolled onto his back and started to snore. Sometime, she didn't know when, she closed her eyes and reached out, placing a hand in the hollow of his stomach, feeling it rise and fall with his breathing. It was like resting her hand on the ocean in summer, when the tide was coming in. Touching him, she fell asleep. The nightmares wouldn't let her go. In some distant part of her brain, she heard her own whimpering, heard Sophie say,
Maman, you're taking all the blankets.
But none of it wakened her. In her nightmare, she was in a chair being interrogated.
The boy, Daniel, he's a Jew. Give him to me,
Van Richter said, shoving his gun in her face. Then his face changed. Melted a little, and he turned into Beck, who was holding the photograph of his wife and shaking his head, but the side of his face was missing, and then Isabelle lying on the floor, bleeding, saying,
I'm sorry, Vian.
And Vian was yelling,
You're not welcome here.
Vian woke with a start, breathing hard. The same nightmares had plagued her for 6 days, She consistently woke, feeling exhausted and worried. It was November now, and there had been no word about Isabel at all. She eased out from beneath the blankets. The floor was cold, but not as cold as it would be in a few weeks. She reached for the shawl she'd left on the foot of the bed and wrapped it around her shoulders. Von Richter had claimed the upstairs bedroom. Vianne had abandoned the floor to him, choosing to move with her children into the smaller downstairs bedroom where they slept together on the double bed. Beck's room. No wonder she dreamt of him in here. The air held onto his scent, reminded her that the man she'd known no longer lived, that she had killed him. She longed to do penance for this sin, but what could she do? She had killed a man, a decent man, in spite of it all. It didn't matter to her that he was the enemy, or even that she'd done it to save her sister. She knew she had made the right choice. It wasn't right or wrong that haunted her. It was the act itself. Murder. She left the bedroom and closed the door behind her, shutting it with a quiet click. Von Richter sat on the divan, reading a novel, drinking a cup of real coffee. The aroma made her almost sick with longing. The Nazi had billeted here for several days already, and each of those mornings had smelled of rich, bitter roasted coffee, and Von Richter made sure she smelled it and wanted it. But she couldn't have so much as a sip. He made sure of that, too. Yesterday morning, he had dumped an entire pot into the sink, smiling at her as he did so. He was a man who had stumbled into a little bit of power and seized it with both hands. She'd known that within the first few hours of his arrival, when he'd chosen the best room and gathered up the warmest blankets for his bed, when he'd taken all of the pillows left in the house and all of the candles, leaving Vianne a single oil lamp for her use. "Herr Sturmbannführer," she said, smoothing her shapeless dress and worn cardigan. He didn't look up from the German newspaper that held his attention.
"More coffee."
She took his empty cup and went to the kitchen, returning quickly with another cup.
"The Allies are wasting their time in North Africa," he said, taking the cup from her, putting it on the table beside him.
"Oui, Herr Sturmbannführer."
His hand snaked out and coiled around her wrist, tight enough to leave a bruise.
"I am having men over for supper tonight. You will cook. And keep that boy away from me. His crying sounds like a dying pig."
He let go.
"Oui, Herr Sturmbannführer."
She got out of his way quickly, hurrying into the bedroom and closing the door behind her. She bent and wakened Daniel, feeling his soft breathing against the crook of her neck.
"Maman,"
he mumbled around his thumb, which he was furiously sucking.
"Sophie is snoring too loud."
Vianne smiled and reached over to tussle Sophie's hair. Amazingly, even though it was wartime and they were terrified and starving, somehow a girl her age could still manage to sleep through anything.
"You sound like a water buffalo, Sophie," Vianne teased.
"Very funny,"
Sophie muttered, sitting up. She glanced at the closed door.
"Is Herr Doifor still here?"
"Sophie,"
Vianne admonished, glancing worriedly at the closed door.
"He can't hear us," Sophie said.
"Still," Vianne said quietly. "I cannot imagine why you would compare our guest to a bug that eats potatoes."
She tried not to smile. Danielle hugged Vianne and gave her a sloppy kiss. As she patted his back and held him close, nuzzling the downy softness of his cheek, she heard a car engine start up.
"Thank God."
"He is leaving," she murmured to the boy, nuzzling his cheek. "Come along, Sophie."
She carried Daniel into the living room, which still smelled of freshly brewed coffee and men's cologne, and began her day. People had called Isabel impetuous for as long as she could remember, and then rash, and most lately, reckless. In the past year, She had grown up enough to see the truth in it. From earliest memory, she had acted first and thought about consequences later. Perhaps it was because she'd felt alone for so long. No one had ever been her sounding board, her best friend. She hadn't had someone with whom to strategize or work through her problems. Beyond that, she had never had great impulse control, maybe because she'd never had anything to lose. Now, she knew what it meant to be afraid, to want something or someone. So much it made your heart ache. The old Isabel would simply have told Gaëtan she loved him and let the cards fall as they would. The new Isabel wanted to walk away without even trying. She didn't know if she had the strength to be rejected again. And yet, they were at war. Time was the one luxury no one had anymore. Tomorrow felt as ephemeral as a kiss in the dark. She stood in the small, pitch-roofed cupboard they used as a water closet in the safe house. Gaëtan had carried up buckets of hot water for her bath, and she had luxuriated in the copper tub until the water cooled. The mirror on the wall was cracked and hung askew. It made her reflection appear disjointed, with one side of her face slightly lower than the other. "How can you be afraid?" she said to her reflection. She had hiked the Pyrenees in the falling snow and swum the rushing cold waters of the Bidasoa River beneath the glare of a Spanish searchlight. She'd once asked a Gestapo agent to carry a suitcase full of false identity papers across a German checkpoint because he looked so strong and she was so very tired from traveling. But she had never been as nervous as she was right now. She knew suddenly that a woman could change her whole life and uproot her existence with one choice. Taking a deep breath, she wrapped herself in a tattered towel and returned to the safe house's main room. She paused at the door just long enough to calm her racing heart, a failed attempt, and then she opened the door. Gaëtan stood by the blacked-out window in his torn and tattered clothes still stained with her blood. She smiled nervously and reached for the end of the towel she'd tucked in at her chest. He went so still, it seemed he'd stopped breathing, even as her breathing sped up. "Don't do it, Iz." His eyes narrowed. Before, she would have said it was anger, but now she knew better. She unwrapped the towel, let it fall to the floor. The bandage on her gunshot wound was all she wore now.
"What do you want from me?"
he said.
"You know."
"You're an innocent. It's war. I'm a criminal. How many reasons do you need to stay away from me?"
They were arguments for another world.
"If times were different, I'd make you chase me," she said, taking a step forward. "I would have made you jump through hoops to get me naked. But we don't have time, do we?"
At the quiet admission, she felt a wave of sadness. This had been the truth between them from the beginning. They had no time. They couldn't court and fall in love and get married and have babies. They might not even have tomorrow. She hated that her first time would be bathed in sorrow, steeped in a sense of having already lost what they'd just found. But that was the world now. One thing she knew for sure. She wanted him to be the first man in her bed. She wanted to remember him for as long as forever was.
"The nuns always said I would come to a bad end."
"I think they meant you." He came toward her, cupped her face in his hands.
"You terrify me, Isabel."
"Kiss me,"
was all she could say. At the first touch of his lips, everything changed. Or Isabel changed. A shudder of desire moved through her, stopped her breath. She felt lost within his arms and found, broken apart and remade. The words, "I love you," burned in her, desperate to be given voice. But even more, she wanted to hear the words, to be told just once that she was loved.
"You're going to be sorry you did this," he said.
How could he say that?
"Never." "Will you be sorry?"
I already am, he said quietly. Then he kissed her again. Chapter 29 The next week was one of almost unbearable bliss for Isabel. There were long conversations by candlelight, and holding hands, and stroking skin, nights of awaking into an aching desire and making love and falling into sleep again. On this day, as on each of the others, Isabel woke still tired and slightly in pain. The wound in her shoulder had begun healing enough that it itched and ached. She felt Gaëtan beside her, his body warm and solid. She knew he was awake. Maybe it was his breathing, or the way his foot rubbed absently against hers, or the quiet. She just knew. In the past days, she'd become a student of him. Nothing he did was too small or insignificant for her to notice. She'd repeatedly thought, "Remember this," over the smallest of details. She had read countless romantic novels in her life, and she had dreamed of love forever. Even so, she'd never known that a plain old double mattress could become a world unto itself, an oasis. She turned onto her side and reached past Gaëtan to light the lamp. In the pale glow of it, she settled close to him, an arm draped across his chest. A tiny silver scar cut through his messy hairline. She reached out to touch it, traced it with her fingertip.
"My brother threw a rock at me. I was too slow to duck," he said. "Georges," he said fondly.
The tenor of his voice reminded Isabel that Gaëtan's brother was a prisoner of war. He had a whole life she knew almost nothing about. A mother who was a seamstress, and a father who raised pigs. He lived in the woods somewhere, in a house with no running water, and only a single room for all of them. He answered her questions about all of it, but volunteered almost nothing. He said he preferred to hear her stories about the adventures that had gotten her kicked out of so many schools.
"It's better than stories of poor people just trying to get by," he said.
But beneath all their words, the stories traded back and forth, she felt their time eroding. They couldn't stay here long. Already, they'd overstayed. She was fit enough to travel, not to cross the Pyrenees, perhaps, but certainly she didn't need to lie abed. How could she leave him? They might never see each other again. That was the crux of her fear.
"I get it, you know," Gaëtan said.
She didn't know what he meant, but she heard the hollowness in his voice and knew it wasn't good. The sadness that came from being in his bed matched equally with joy, expanded.
"Get what?"
she asked, but she didn't want to hear.
"That every time we kiss, it's goodbye."
She closed her eyes.
"The war is out there, Is. I need to get back to it."
She knew and agreed, though it caused a constriction in her chest.
"I know,"
was all she could say, afraid that any deeper exploration would hurt more than she could bear.
"There is a group gathering at Arugne," she said. "I should be there by nightfall on Wednesday, if we're lucky."
"We are not lucky," he said. "You must know that by now."
"You are wrong, Gaëtan. Now that you've met me, you'll never be able to forget me. That's something."
She leaned over for a kiss. He said something softly, quietly against her lips. Maybe it was.
"It's not enough."
She didn't care. She didn't want to hear. In November, the people of Carivaux began to hunker down into winter survival mode again. They knew now what they hadn't known last winter. Life could get worse. War was being waged all over the world, in Africa, in the Soviet Union, in Japan, on an island somewhere called Guadalcanal. With the Germans fighting on so many fronts, food had become even more scarce, as had wood and gas and electricity and everyday supplies. This Friday morning was particularly cold and gray. Not a good day for venturing out. But Vian had decided that today was the day. It had taken some time to work up the courage to leave the house with Daniel. But she knew that it had to be done. His hair was cut so short he was almost bald, and she'd dressed him in oversized clothes to make him look smaller, anything to disguise him. She forced herself to show good posture as she walked through town, with a child on each side of her, Sophie and Daniel. Daniel. At the boulangerie, she took her place at the back of the queue. She waited breathlessly for someone to ask about the boy beside her, but the women in line were too tired and hungry and downtrodden even to look up. When it was finally Vian's turn at the counter, Yvette looked up. She had been a beautiful woman only 2 years ago, with flowing copper-colored hair and eyes as black as coal. Now, 3 years into the war, she looked aged and tired.
Vian Mauriac, I have not seen you with your daughter for a while. Bonjour, Sophie. You have grown so tall.
She peered over the counter.
And who is this good-looking young man?
Daniel,
he said proudly. Vian placed a trembling hand on his shorn head.
I adopted him from Antoine's cousin in Nice. She died.
Yvette pushed the frizzy hair out of her eyes, pulled a strand of it out of her mouth as she stared down at the toddler. She had 3 sons of her own, one not much older than Daniel. Vian's heart hammered in her chest. Yvette stepped back from the counter. She went to the small door that separated the shop from the bakery.
Herr Lieutenant, she said, could you come out here?
Vian tightened her grip on her willow basket handle, working it as if it were piano keys. A portly German ambled out of the back room, his arms overflowing with freshly baked baguettes. He saw Vian and stopped.
Madame,
he said, his apple cheeks bulging at the fullness of his mouth. Vian could barely nod. Yvette said to the soldier,
There's no more bread today, Herr Lieutenant. If I make more, I will save the best for you and your men. This poor woman couldn't even get a day-old baguette.
The man's eyes narrowed appreciatively. He moved toward Vian, his flat feet thumping on the stone floor. Wordlessly, he dropped a half-eaten baguette into her basket. Then he nodded and left the shop, a little bell tinkling at his exit. When they were alone, Yvette moved in close to Vian, so close she had to fight the urge to step back.
I heard you have an SS officer in your house now. What happened to the handsome captain?
He disappeared,
Vian said evenly.
No one knows.
No one? Why did they bring you in for questioning? Everyone saw you go in.
I am just a housewife. What could I possibly know of such things?
Yvette stared at her a moment longer, assessing Vian in the silence. Then she stepped back.
You are a good friend, Vian Mauriac, she said quietly.
Vian nodded briefly and herded the children to the door. The days of stopping to talk to friends on the street were gone. Now it was dangerous enough to simply make eye contact. Friendly conversation had gone the way of butter and coffee and pork. Outside, Vian paused on the cracked stone step, through which a lush patch of frosted weeds pushed up. She was wearing a winter coat she had made from a tapestried bedspread. She had copied a pattern she'd seen in a magazine, double-breasted, knee-length, with a wide lapel and button she'd taken from one of her mother's favorite Harris tweed jackets. It was warm enough for today, but soon she would need layers of newsprint between her sweater and her coat. Vian retied the scarf around her head and knotted it more tightly beneath her chin as the icy wind hit her full in the face. Leaves skittered across the stone aisle, cartwheeled across her booted feet. She held tightly to Daniel's mittened hand and stepped out into the street. She knew instantly that something was wrong. There were German soldiers and French gendarmes everywhere, in cars, on motorcycles, marching up the icy street, gathered in pods at the cafes. Whatever was happening out here, it couldn't be good. And it was always best to stay away from the soldiers, especially since the Allied victories in North Africa.
Come on, Sophie and Daniel. Let's go home.
She tried to turn right at the corner, but found the street barricaded. All up and down the street, doors were locked and shutters were closed. The bistros were empty. There was a terrible sense of danger in the air. The next street she tried was barricaded, too. A pair of Nazi soldiers stood guard at it, their rifles pointed at her. Behind them, German soldiers marched up the street toward them, goose-stepping in formation. Vian took the children's hands and picked up their pace, but one street after another was barricaded and guarded. It became clear that there was a plan in place. Lorries and buses were thundering up the cobblestone streets toward the town square. Vian came to the square and stopped, breathing hard, pulling the children in close to her sides. Pandemonium. There were buses lined up in a row, disgorging passengers, all of whom wore a yellow star. Women and children were being forced, pushed, herded into the square. Nazis stood on the perimeter, a terrible, frightening patrol edge, while French policemen pulled people out of the buses, yanked jewelry from women's necks, shoved them at gunpoint.
Maman!
Sophie cried. Vian clamped a hand over her daughter's mouth. To her left, a young woman was shoved to the ground and then hauled back up by her hair and dragged through the crowd.
Vian!
She swung around, saw Hélène Rouelle carrying a small leather suitcase and holding a little boy's hand. An older boy stood close to her side. A yellow, tattered star identified them.
Take my sons,
Hélène said desperately to Vian.
Here?
Vian said, glancing around.
No, maman, the older boy said. Papa told me to take care of you. I am not leaving you. If you let go of my hand, I'll just follow you. Better we stay together.
Behind them, another whistle shrieked. Hélène shoved the younger boy into Vian, pushed him hard against Daniel.
He is Jean-Georges, like his uncle. 4 years old this June. My husband's people are in Burgundy.
I have no papers for him. They'll kill me if I take him.
You,
a Nazi shouted at Hélène. He came up behind her, grabbed her by the hair, almost yanking her off her feet. She slammed into her older son, who strove to keep her upright. And then Hélène and her son were gone, lost in the crowd. The boy was beside her, wailing,
Maman!
And sobbing.
We need to leave, Vian said to Sophie. Now!
She clutched Jean-Georges's hand so tightly he cried harder. Every time he yelled,
Maman!
She flinched and prayed for him to be quiet. They hurried up one street and down the other, dodging the barricades and bypassing the soldiers who were breaking down doors and herding Jewish people into the square. Twice they were stopped and allowed to pass because they had no stars on their clothing. On the muddy road, she had to slow down, but she didn't stop, even when both boys started crying. At Le Jardin, Vian finally stopped. Von Richter's black Citroën was parked out front.
Oh, no,
Sophie said. Vian looked down at her terrified daughter and saw her own fear replicated in the beloved eyes, and all at once she knew what she needed to do.
We have to try to save him, or we are as bad as they are, she said.
And there it was. She hated to bring her daughter into this, but what choice was there?
I have to save this boy.
How?
I don't know yet, Vian admitted. But von Richter...
As if drawn by his own name, the Nazi appeared at the front door, looking fussily precise in his uniform.
Ah, Madame Mauriac, he said, his gaze narrowing as he approached her. There you are.
Vianne struggled for calm.
We have been to town for shopping.
Not a good day for that. Jews are being collected for deportation.
He walked toward her, his boots tamping down the wet grass. Beside him, the apple tree was barren of leaves. Bits of fabric fluttered from the empty branches. Red, pink, white. A new one for Beck, in black.
And who is this fine-looking youngster?
Von Richter said, touching the child's tear-streaked cheek with one black-gloved finger.
A friend's boy. His mother died of tuberculosis this week.
Von Richter lurched backwards, as if she'd said bubonic plague.
I don't want that child in the house. Is that understood? You will take him to the orphanage this instant.
The orphanage? Mother Marie-Thérèse? She nodded.
Of course, Herr Sturmbannführer.
He made a flicking gesture with his hand as if to say,
Go, now.
He started to walk away. Then he stopped and turned back to face Vianne.
I want you home this evening for supper.
I am always home, Herr Sturmbannführer.
We leave tomorrow, and I want you to feed me and my men a good meal before we go.
Leave?
She asked, feeling a spike of hope.
We are occupying the rest of France tomorrow. No more free zone. It's about damn time. Letting you French govern yourselves was a joke. Good day, madam.
Vianne remained where she was, standing still, holding the child's hand. Above the sound of Jean-Georges crying, she heard the gate squeak open and slam shut, then a car engine started up. When he was gone, Sophie said,
Will Mother Marie-Thérèse hide him?
I hope so.
Take Daniel into the house and lock the door. Don't open it for anyone but me. I'll be back as soon as I can.
Sophie looked old for her age suddenly, wise beyond her years.
Good for you, Maman.
We shall see,
was all the hope she had left. When her children were safely in the house, with the door locked, she said to the boy beside her,
Come, Jean-Georges. We are going for a walk. To my maman?
She couldn't look at him.
Come.
As Vianne and the boy walked back to town, an intermittent rain began. Jean-Georges alternately cried and complained, but Vianne was so nervous she barely heard him. How could she ask Mother Superior to take this risk? How could she not? They walked past the church to the convent hidden behind it. The Order of the Sisters of St. Joseph had begun in 1650 with six like-minded women who simply wanted to serve the poor in their community. They had grown to thousands of members throughout France until religious communities were forbidden by the state during the French Revolution. Some of the original six sisters had become martyrs for their beliefs, guillotined for their faith. Vianne went to the abbey's front door and lifted the heavy iron knocker, letting it fall against the oak door, clattering hard.
Why are we here?
Jean-Georges whined.
Is my maman here?
Shh! A nun answered, her sweet, plump face bracketed by the white wimple and black hood of her habit.
Ah, Vianne, she said, smiling.
Sister Agatha, I would like to speak to Mother Superior, if that's possible. The nun stepped back, her habit swishing on the stone floor.
I will see. You two take a seat in the garden.
Vianne nodded. Merci. She and Jean-Georges made their way through the cold cloisters. At the end of one arched corridor, they turned left and went into the garden. It was good-sized and square, with frosted brown grass, and a marble lion's head fountain, and several stone benches placed here and there. Vianne took a seat on one of the cold benches out of the rain and pulled the boy up beside her. She didn't have long to wait. "Bian," Mother said, coming forward, her habit dragging on the grass, her fingers closed around the large crucifix that hung from a chain around her neck. "How good it is to see you. It's been too long. And who is this young man?" The boy looked up.
"Is my maman here?"
Vian met Mother Superior's even gaze with one of her own. "His name is Jean-Georges Rouel, Mother. I would speak to you alone if we could." Mother clapped her hands, and a young nun appeared to take the boy away. When they were alone, Mother Superior sat down beside Vian. Vian couldn't corral her thoughts, and so a silence fell between them. "I am sorry about your friend Rachel."
"And so many others," Vian said.
Mother nodded.
"We have heard terrible rumors coming from Radio London about what is happening in the camps.
Perhaps our Holy Father..."
"He is silent on this matter," Mother said, her voice heavy with disappointment.
Vian took a deep breath.
"Hélène Rouel and her elder son were deported today. Jean-Georges is alone. His mother left him with me."
"Left him with you?" Mother paused. "It is dangerous to have a Jewish child in your home, Vian."
"I want to protect him," she said quietly.
Mother looked at her. She was silent so long that Vian's fear began to put down roots, grow.
"And how would you accomplish this?"
she asked at last.
"Hide him."
"Where?"
Vian looked at Mother, saying nothing. Mother's face drained of color.
"Here?"
"An orphanage. What better place?"
Mother Superior stood and then sat. Then she stood again. Her hands moved to the cross, held it. Slowly, she sat down again. Her shoulders sagged, and then straightened when her decision was made.
"A child in our care needs papers. Baptismal certificates.
I can get those, of course, but identity papers..." "I will get them," Vian said,
although she had no idea if it were possible.
"You know that it is illegal to hide Jews now. The punishment is deportation if you're lucky. And lately, I believe no one is lucky in France."
Vian nodded. Then Mother Superior said,
"I will take the boy. And I could make room for more than one Jewish child."
"More?"
"Of course there are more, Vian. I will speak to a man I know in Giraud. He works for L'œuvre de secours aux enfants, the Help the Children Fund. I expect he will know many families and children in hiding. I will tell him to expect you."
Me?
"You are the leader of this now, and if we are risking our lives for one child, we may as well try to save more."
Mother got abruptly to her feet. She hooked her arm through Vian's, and the two women strolled the perimeter of the small garden.
"No one here can know the truth. The children will have to be coached and have paperwork that passes inspection. And you would need a position here, perhaps as a teacher, as a part-time teacher. That would allow us to pay you a small stipend and would answer questions about why you were here with the children."
Vian
said, feeling shaky.
"Don't look so afraid, Vian. You are doing the right thing."
She had no doubt that this was true, and still she was terrified.
"This is what they have done to us. We are afraid of our own shadows."
She looked at Mother.
"How will I do it? Go to scared, hungry women and ask them to give me their children?"
"You will ask them if they've seen their friends being herded onto trains and taken away. You will ask them what they would risk to keep their child off of that train. Then you will let each mother decide."
"It is an unimaginable choice. I'm not sure I could do it, just hand Sophie and Daniel over to a stranger."
Mother leaned close.
I hear one of their awful stormtroopers is billeted at your house. You realize this puts you and Sophie at terrible risk.
Of course. But how can I let her believe it's all right to do nothing in times such as these?
Mother stopped. Releasing Vian, she laid a soft palm against her cheek and smiled tenderly.
Be careful, Vian. I have already been to your mother's funeral. I do not want to attend yours.
Chapter 30. On an ice-cold mid-November day, Isabel and Gaetan left Brantôme and boarded a train to Bayonne. The carriage was overflowing with solemn German soldiers, more so than usual, and when they disembarked, they found more soldiers crowding the platform. Isabel held Gaetan's hand as they made their way through the gray-green uniforms. Two young lovers on their way to the beach town.
My maman used to love going to the beach. Did I ever tell you that?
Isabel asked as they passed near two SS officers.
You rich kids see all the good stuff.
She smiled.
We were hardly rich, Gaetan, she said, when they were outside the train station.
Well, you weren't poor, he said. I know poor.
He paused, let that settle between them, and then he said,
I could be rich someday. Someday,
he said again with a sigh, and she knew what he was thinking. It was what they were always thinking. Will there be a France in our future? Gaetan slowed. Isabel saw what had captured his attention.
Keep moving, he said.
A roadblock had been set up ahead of them. Troops were everywhere, carrying rifles.
What's going on?
Isabel asked.
They've seen us,
Gaetan said. He tightened his hold on her hand. They strolled toward the swarm of German soldiers. A burly, square-headed sentry blocked their way and demanded to see their passes and papers. Isabel offered her Juliet papers. Gaetan offered his own false documents. But the soldier was more interested in the goings-on behind him. He barely glanced at the documents and handed them back. Isabel gave him her most innocent smile.
What's happening today?
No more free zone, the soldier said, waving them through.
No more free zone? But...
We are taking over all of France, he said roughly. No more pretense that your ridiculous Vichy government is in charge anywhere. Go!
Gaetan pulled her forward through the amassing troops. For hours as they walked, they were honked at by German lorries and automobiles in a hurry to get past them. It wasn't until they reached the quaint seaside town of Saint-Jean-de-Luz that they were able to escape the gathering Nazis. They walked along the empty seawall, perched high above the pounding surf of the Atlantic Ocean. Below them, a curl of yellow sand held the mighty, angry ocean at bay. In the distance, a lush green peninsula was dotted with houses built in the Basque tradition, with white sides and red doors and bright red tile roofs. The sky overhead was a faded, washed-out blue, with clouds stretched as taut as clotheslines. There were no other people out today, neither on the beach nor walking along the ancient seawall. For the first time in hours, Isabel could breathe.
What does it mean, no free zone?
It is not good, that's for sure. It will make your work more dangerous.
I've been moving through occupied territory already.
She tightened her hold on his hand and led him off the seawall. They stepped down the uneven steps and made their way to the road.
We used to vacation here when I was little, she said, before my maman died.
At least that's what I've heard. I barely remember. She wanted it to be the start of a conversation, but her words fell into the new silence between them and went unanswered. In the quiet, Isabel felt the suffocating weight of missing him, even though he was holding her hand.
Why hadn't she asked him more questions in their days together?